Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. My name is Michael Lewis Engerman. I'm the host of Soul Tree Radio and the Raw. We have done, over the past 11 years, as this is our 11th year, 1,601 shows. Most have been pretty damn good. But we realized at some point in time that some of the information that we've revealed on shows may inadvertently be keys to connecting the dots to a murder. The murder of one Ray Grygar, who was a prosecutor in Pennsylvania. Mr. Grygar was involved indirectly with the Jerry Sandusky trial, Second Mile, and cases of sexual perversion against kids. What we want to do is go back and put together something, do some of these shows, and see if we can get enough information to make 2 plus 2 equal 4. We hope that you will enjoy the show, and feel free to check out our site on Facebook for more information. Good evening.
Bring a horse for me.
That's like we're just like we shy one horse.
Too many.
Welcome to a special Over the Hump Day edition as our staff of chefs are slapping together a brain buffet guaranteed to provide good food for thought as we present another soul-stirring edition of Soul Tree Radio in the Raw. I'm your host, Michael Lewis, thank you, DJ Honeycomb, and as always, it is good to be in the house with you. Soul Tree Radio in the Raw, sponsored by the Black Athletes What's That Work, Roland Rogers, CEO of Loving Memory, our friends at Blog Talk, our friends and colleagues at 1450 WCLM AM, the Soul of Richmond, Virginia, Cowboy Reggie and crew do sports talk every Saturday afternoon from noon to 1 p.m., as well as our brother station, sister station, WUFO, 1080 AM, The Mix, out of Buffalo, New York, where Pat Freeman, the mighty Oba, serves it up 4 to 5 every Saturday afternoon with the number one sports show in the nation, doing great work for the citizens of Western New York and making sure that a clearer path involving the stadium madness up there is made available and that hardworking folks will actually get a say in their future as opposed to being dictated to by a handful of wannabe elites. In addition, I want to recognize my brother Anthony Johnson, who does his thing Saturdays now. The Anthony Johnson Show, Saturdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, 6 to 7, on Blog Talk Radio, after Gary Gray and the Great Upper Cole, as well as our colleagues Leonard Hanson and Mike Feely at Guardian Caps, my buddies FC SB Starbuck and Joey Savage do the Savage and Starbuck Show, Wednesday night, 10 to 10:30 Central, 11:30 Eastern, and the rest of the Soul Tree staff of chefs who are here doing what they can, trying to make sense out of a very insane environment as it stands right now. Now, there's a few things we're going to chop up tonight because as sometimes you have that big meal and other times you eat light, I think salad is in more what's going to be served this evening, as we're going to have several topics to chop up. Among the first of these, this was one that was dropped on me and inspired by my cousin Duval Hunter, hollering out to my cousin Du, because we here at Soul Tree Radio in the Raw, in conjunction with our friend and colleague Eric Satterwhite, one of our chefs, has been steadfast in bringing out this whole network of perverts who have been doing unspeakable things to children. You can't even call it sex. It's sex abuse, molestation, whatever you want to call it. It ain't sex. Sex is with consenting adults. And these by no means are consenting adults that a lot of this stuff has jumped off with. We've been on this ever since the first vestiges of the Penn State incident happened with Jerry Sandusky. We've been consistent in reporting information on this. We've also been consistent in keeping track of the motherfuckers involved in this shit and how sex rings have been busted here and abroad with pornography, with material that some people would just shake their heads of. And as we always say, the ones that are the most fervent or pious about shit like this are likely the ones that are behind all of this shit, because the more pious they are, seems the freakier the fuck they are. And now on the heels of all of this shit comes this new angle to this bullshit where a professor out of Rutgers University, a woman named Margot Kaplan, has the nerve to say straight up that pedophilia is not a crime. She's trying to play it out like it's some sort of mental disorder. Now, she's saying essentially that pedophiles don't necessarily turn out to be child molesters, and that pedophilia is not a choice, i.e. a pedophile being born that way. But as she's running this bullshit down, the dialogue deviates to such a level that's been on it and try to imply that it's some sort of like, well, like Down syndrome is trisomy for chromosome 23 is bullshit. Because as she's trying to describe what a pedophile is, she's saying a person with an intense and recurrent sexual attraction to prepubescent children, children who have not yet entered any form of puberty. And according to the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, Mental Disorders, it constitutes a mental disorder when you act on it. But not just that, it also constitutes a mental disorder if it causes marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. And as you can imagine, pedophilia will cause this. And to all of this, I say that's bullshit. No. Just as racism is learned behavior, a lot of this is learned behavior. And many of the people who were molested themselves. But that doesn't change the fact. Making a conscious decision to do this to a child has nothing to do with any kind of sickness. This speaks to a premeditated mindset. And you don't learn how to hate just from one incident. It's consistent. It has to be long stem and binding in its actions and in the long-term effects of it, which is why kids don't start out racist. But if they're in a home where the parents are saying all of this shit, yes, it will get to them. So now we have the same thing here. This same paradigm is laid out. And this woman is trying to justify this whole nonsense. So again, they're saying, kids, if you've got this predisposition to think that you can look at a six-year-old and go, oh, yeah, I want that, that it's a disorder. No, it's not a disorder. I think it's beyond disorder when you give a climate where it's endorsed to not just do this, but try to lobby and argue that it's okay. And this is exactly the mindset that the North American Man Boy Love Association, which is called NAMBLA, and I may have made a mistake in calling out what their acronym was in a previous show, and for that I apologize because I want to get it right. But when NAMBLA laid all of this out, they were lobbying to make sure everybody understood that their goal was to promote this. This was their mandate. They wanted to make sure that throughout what spin they wanted to lay on this, at the end of the day, they wanted to have the right to fuck little boys, little girls, or do whatever the fuck they wanted, and it was going to be mandated because they were going to go down as a not-for-profit entity. So on top of everything else, not only were they going to promote their sick agenda, they were going to make money off this shit and not pay taxes on it. Now, out of all of their perverts, Allen Ginsberg, the writer, was also one of these cats that signed up on this shit. So now you've got somebody who's intellectually locked in and can put a spin on paper as to what, oh, yeah, well, you know, this isn't anything wrong. There's nothing wrong about this. That's bullshit. So we've laid all of this out, and now we've got so-called professionals trying to justify this. And the fact that they continue to do this is an indication that there's been heat on them, considerable heat put on them, since Sandusky got exposed. And Sandusky got exposed as not just some creep who's walking around, not sitting in movie theaters with a raincoat on, but the worst kind of predator, because taking these kids and turned them into a little pervert supermarket for the time that he was there running second mile. He had like-minded individuals backing him up, and he was getting endorsements from everybody, from the former governor of the state, who then was the attorney general in Jim Corbett. And then you also had the same nonsense spread from here up to the White House, because Bush Jr. endorsed him as being, check that, Bush Sr. endorsed him as being one of his thousand points of light in talking about the great work that these guys were doing. While all these guys were straight up pimps, prostituting kids. We talked on our show consistently about how Penn State put one of these kids on a plane, sent them down there with Sandusky and crew to a bowl game in Texas. We don't know if they shipped this kid off to be prostituted around. They said he was in the manifest a family member. Damn well he wasn't a family member, because we brought it all up. And as all of this thing started to unravel and Joe Paterno dies and all this other bullshit, and they try to make it seem like he knew nothing when we knew damn well in that section of the country, his word was law. He was like a fucking capo over there. And the fact that he died and got away, literally, and I'm saying it exactly like that, reminded me of the scene in either the first or second Lethal Weapon when Danny Glover is standing over the guy that he got shot. He said, "You got away, you son of a bitch. You got off easy." And that's exactly what happened to Paterno. He got off easy. And we know that a certain television network tried to pretend to be journalists in saying that they were going to go hard after him. And then when Paterno was put on TV, Paterno Jr., that is, they bitched up and said nothing. They threw him softball questions, and he sat there as if butter had not melted in his mouth and went on about, well, we're not going to do anything about this because we're going to get this all corrected. Our father's thing is going to be corrected, and his win's back. And that's exactly what happened. They got everything back. The $60 million fine, that was all returned back. Everything was returned back, except the psyches of those kids affected by all this bullshit. And this is where the problem manifests itself even greater, because now, in the wake of everything that happened at Penn State, in the wake of everything that happened at Syracuse, with the basketball players up there and the wife of one of the coaches fucking the boys up there, not the boys, but the guys, literally the players on the team, which is a separate category from the little kids that were being molested by the coach, Bernie Fine. More news comes out about everybody. Literally everybody, from the Catholic Church to sex, the Vatican to the royal family in the UK because of Jimmy Savile and the shit that he did, and other things, busts of sites where pornography was at such a rate, where there was so much of it, and we're talking specifically porn against children, where one site set up a club where the more sick your shit was, the more points you got. By the time they had picked all the stuff up, and we've been through this in describing it before, by the time they had picked all this up, they had enough material to produce over 16,000 90-minute versions of various forms of child porn. And as this continues to go up, and as the pressure hits, and as more people are getting busted, what's been unfortunately not noticed is the fact that people aren't going to jail for this. You see stuff being picked up. You see folks being rounded up, but nobody's being really arrested other than Sandusky, which makes me feel sadly that Sandusky, because he was so blatant about his shit, he wasn't supposed to get arrested either. And as I say this, Cowboy Reggie from WCLM is in the mix. And Cowboy, we've been down this road before, but now comes new information as the spin continues that a professor out of Rutgers University is trying to say that, well, pedophilia is not a crime and shouldn't be considered a crime because it's a disorder. First of all, good evening, and give me your idea on this, please.
Well, good evening, my friend, and thank you for persevering. In my opinion, and our honesty, as we talk clarity, I have to reference what I say about Dr. Francis Wilson and the ISIS theory. And I mean it from the bottom of my heart when I talk about the penis envy with a lot of homosexuality. This something is real. They use the church, be it Catholic, being in religion, to justify it. And I will say the same thing that I said before, that you have an undertow of this immoral act. But yet, when it comes to one of the presidents that the group called Long Cabin Group is named after, Lincoln, we have to, again, connect the dots. Current President Obama has overwhelmingly said that now I look at homosexuality in a different manner. No other president has ever stepped up and said that. That's something major right there. And I would say the same thing I said before, that look at the diversity of which gays are starting to come out and forth, and they're putting their money where their mouth is. That's why you're starting to see a lot of laws being relaxed, and that's why you're starting to see a lot of states having same-sex marriages, in my opinion.
Well, as you say this, as I look through this interview, this doctor who's come up with this theory, I won't say doctor, but this law professor, which is what she is, her argument is flipping back to this whole premise that, well, you know, if you see kids and you got a hard on or whatever, whatnot, you know, that doesn't mean you should act on it. I'm like, what the fuck? Get the fuck out of here. You know, if you find something that's a disease, it doesn't mean that it's not a disease, but still, kids should be protected at all costs. For somebody to lay out this kind of nonsense, I think is irresponsible. It's not responsible. As you look at this, the more and more that they talk about this, it still hasn't come back to the other side of the scale with regard to balance. All right, it's a crime, and when you get punished for a crime, there should be sufficient punishment to deter. So that if somebody really thinks about doing this, they'll think, well, you know, I better not do this. So if her whole argument is that, well, if it's a disorder, then, you know, we should let people know that you shouldn't act on it. Well, if you tell somebody, if I catch you fucking kids, if I catch you involved in pedophilia, that it's 50 years in jail without parole, do you think you're likely to act on it? So this is the issue. The level of punishment comes not even remotely close to this, which gives me the vibe that too many of these people that she's trying to alibi for are into this sick shit themselves. And I've maintained this and spoke on this other times as well. Many of these same people she's reaching to, when she speaks about this and trying to make the logic for this work, they're judges, they're people who are folks high up on the scale in careers, and they're not the lowlifes that are perceived to be, or if they are, they are. Those lowlifes are in the minority. Too many of these other folks are into this sick shit, and I'm talking straight up through the Catholic Church, as well as the Vatican and other places where stuff has been revealed as more and more of these things have been busted out ever since we started talking about this from the Penn State issue back when Sandusky got busted. Sandusky, I think, was a loose cannon, and when he got caught, all of this shit started to unravel because there were other indications that this wasn't an isolated deal, and the fact that he was busted to the degree that he was put too much attention on it for those who wanted to keep this secret to hash up, and I think that is why all this defensive spin has been put in place on a consistent basis, because from the time we started talking about it to now, Penn State got their money back. Coach Paterno got all his wins back. And with the new hiring of the coach there at Penn State, supposedly everything is all tickety-boo because you know, certain sports entities say so. So we're just supposed to pretend that this shit didn't happen at all. The school keeps making money. The NCAA keeps fucking the kids over. And now this leads us to another thing that indirectly ties into all of this. Apparently, Mike Pence, Indiana's state governor, has signed a Religious Freedom Act, which gives folks license to do the same things that they wanted to do in Arizona before gay power ran them the fuck away and said that when that happened, that and Arizona had to capitulate because too much money was at stake with the Super Bowl. So the short version of Indiana's new law is that whether they tell you or not, the businesses have the right to discriminate. So if you and I were going to go to Indiana, you know, to Indianapolis for the NCAAs, and there was a restaurant that decided due to their religious beliefs that they couldn't serve black people because we were the people of harm and all the other stupid shit, we would not be not just welcome there, but obviously we wouldn't want to eat there because they're telling you straight up, niggas don't come in here. So why would you shop there first of all? But even worse, since this is also the home of the NCAA offices there and the pimp and the pimp council led by Mark Emmert, how do you think they're going to spin this shit to be palatable for everybody else when the governor has told them they have the right to do the same thing that Arizona wanted to do, and even though you may not see no niggas allowed on the side of the lunchrooms or the bathrooms, that's exactly what they want to apply. You can't take a pee, Reggie, because it's against my religious beliefs, so you better go pee outside.
Well, you know, I found it very interesting that the NFL was holding their winter meeting in Arizona.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking, I'm like, what is about Arizona that these European men with money like to flock there? I don't know. It must be in the air. But again, Mike, my issue is that when you have economic leverage, you can make people do things. Let's be honest, the NFL didn't blink. And to one of their main sponsors saying the education case that we're not having it and we're pulling out. That's the only time they blink. Again, Penn State blinked when they got together with their sponsor and said, guess what, touching up people, we're pulling out. You're talking about $25 million. All of a sudden, the alumni come together, some behind-the-scenes move, and of course they put a Negro and say football coach. So, you know, that's for the teaser. Just like that clown that made his remarks about Monique Davis, but that's a whole other story. So I'm just saying, my humble opinion, on a humble, just look at where the economic balance are. Gay guys doing this to little boys and everything. And again, look at the, I got to say, Mike, look at the money. People put the money, all of a sudden things start shooting not to show up anymore.
But see, the money really is the issue. Because when dollars speak, folks pay attention. After Governor Pence signed this law that supposedly was protecting business owners who don't want to serve gay couples, because that's really what started out the shit in Arizona before Mr. Sulu had warped factor 5 on this bullshit. Y'all ain't doing this bullshit. Apparently, the way that they translate this in Indiana did not sit well with a young man named Mark Benioff, who is the CEO of Salesforce.com. These guys, I think, are market researchers and people who specialize in hiring folks. He was supposed to do something in Indiana, and he said straight up in a statement, today we are canceling all programs that require our customers' employees to travel to Indiana to face discrimination. He said, we are forced to dramatically reduce our investment in Indiana based on our employees and customers' outrage over the Religious Freedom Bill. Now, in addition to this, the NCAA, because they realized now that they're caught up in this bullshit, they had to come out with a statement saying that they were expressing concern over the law, and they reiterated their pursuit of an inclusive environment. And again, the pimp leader, Mark Emmert, had to say this bullshit. His quote was, moving forward, we intend to closely examine the implications of this bill and how it might affect future events. In other words, He's scared they motherfuckers gonna lose money behind this bullshit, but we know that.
Thank you.
The bigger issue to this is that Indiana was the home of the Ku Klux Klan, so nobody should really be surprised that this kind of mindset existed there. And as much as they probably would like to say this about black people, they're using this for gays as a springboard to basically discriminate against who the fuck they want to.
Of
so
course.
Again, you won't see signs on the door saying no niggas allowed or white people only or anything like that. But that's really the goal. That's exactly what they really want to fucking say.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll say the same thing again. Since President Obama has been elected, and she might not talk about this, the economy has changed. They have really ratcheted up. And they have said what they said. You had these clowns on the fraternity, and these thousands do what they do. And a lot of these people are worried about the economic downfall. So they're like, look, we got to keep these niggas happy. We got to bring them back into the slave yard, known as the football field. So I'm sorry, man. I tell people, follow the money, follow the money. You'll see which way things are trending.
Well, let's go to that, because there's money being made as we speak, Cowboy, and that's what the NCAA's. And from the jump, we've always contested that the kids ain't getting shit. The kids are employees. The kids need to be paid. But the thing that was revealed last year is something now that HBO has decided to jump on, even though this is something we talked about for years. I give Brian Gumbel credit. Brian Gumbel at least takes on shit that we know a lot of these others are not even going to attempt to touch, aside
okay.
from us. The thing we're speaking on actually right now are the number of collegiate athletes who, after their eligibility is done, are fucked by the schools that they play for. We saw it in front of millions of folks, as others did, when the basketball player from Louisville, where broke his leg or broke his ankle on national TV. Now, in the real world, because he was on his J-O-B when he was out there dribbling on the court, should have been a workman's complication situation. He should have been compensated, and his bills for his medical care should all have been taken care of without any problems. Now, Louisville supposedly paid all his hospital bills not out of the goodness of their heart, but because they got busted on national TV. There's
right.
no way they could have made a salient argument that, well, because that kid broke his leg, that's not our fault. They had to pay for it. And given everything, this was not a national televised game. If this did not happen at the exact time that it did, we have to consider the following. First of all, the kid never would have had the kind of proper medical care that he would have had to totally recover. Because Louisville, after he did get recovered, whisked him under the radar, threw him out literally. Although they want to say he transferred and all that, they want to know part of him. He transferred to Georgia State. I got some measure of revenge when Georgia State made it to the NCAAs and won that game on the coach's son's jump shot. But having said that, after his injuries, if that hadn't happened exactly when it did at the time it did, he'd have been held responsible for his health care. They would have sent him a bill. For all of the stuff that they did, and you got to remember, I think the deductibles for some schools are as high as $90,000. So that was passed easily. He never would have been able to pay that tab. And circumstances put him in a position where he lucked up. Now, he moved on to Georgia State, but there's bunches of athletes, hundreds of athletes, basketball, football. They haven't had that kind of fortune. They've been put in deliberately deleterious situations because the school, even though the school makes them sign a statement before they even do anything guaranteeing that they're going to say that they're amateurs, pimp them out of their eligibility, and then when it's time to be shipped out the pasture, it's like, look, we ain't got nothing to do with your ass. We don't want you here. Goodbye. And that's exactly what happens to a lot of these players.
Well, let's say again, like, my whole thing is that they try over and again. They say, well, you get a free education. And the sad thing about it is that some of my athletes that don't take advantage of the situation, like Dr. Widow always says, that if you get yourself a free education, use your academics in order to further yourself. And then many times I hear men have used the eligibility up, and they back on the block. And that's the sad part about it. you know, be at the YMCA. I hate to say it, but Arkansas, when they won that championship and they had a black coach, guess what? I was a player that didn't even finish that sophomore and junior year. And they had no degree. They was out there on the block. And we know the next year.
That was Nolan Richardson's team. And I remember working on another show railing Nolan Richardson's ass for the fact that their graduation rate was something pitiful, something like 12% or something like that from that team.
And that's it.
Didn't matter. They won the national championship. Yeah, it was national.
Yeah.
They won the championship.
I was standing there.
Mm-hmm. Pig Suey and all that old horse shit. But here's the bigger problem. Here's the bigger problem. You've got these kids now. They've never had a voice to speak on this. And we know that the pimp cartel won't allow it. And we know while Dick Vitale and his scumbag ass is screaming Dipsy through Dunkaroo that they're not going to allow any discourse or some sort of dialogue on all this. They're huckstering this thing. They're going to play this thing out to the bus. And if Ware hadn't happened, if Ware hadn't got hurt when he did, this would be a bigger secret because, again, more and more folks aren't talking about it. And they don't care because all they care about is whether or not so-and-so state is in their bracket and they're moving forward toward the Final Four. You know, now the hype is going towards Kentucky, and I've said this before, I'm going to make sure everybody understands it. I don't like John Calipari. I don't like what he represents because he is a pimp, but he's never made any bones about being anything other than that. Here you had Kentucky who hired him for the express purpose of making sure that he'd make them money and pimp those kids out. You had North Carolina on the other side supposedly being the anti-Calipari. Oh, they do things right and all this other old bullshit. So now comes out this new revelation after Dean Smith is dead that he's given $200 to every letterman that's ever played for him to say, oh, yeah, you know, here's dinner on me. And one of these assholes from MSNBC, I think it was Chris Hayes, whoever the fuck his stupid ass was, had the nerve to say, oh, there was something that he did that I was so impressed of. The fact that he said when he was desegregating restaurants in the 1950s that, doing the right thing, you should never have to apologize for doing the right thing. You should just do the right thing. Well, I would say that's very true. So, Dean Smith, why didn't you do the fucking right thing and tell the world that Dr. John McClendon was really the person who initiated and created the Four Corners and not you? Because if doing the right thing is so important, Reggie, then you know you must do the right thing and not worry about all the other shit. So
we know. Yeah, we know. This is speaking with forked tongue. Yeah, well, out of respect, Mike, when you don't have people who look like us that will fight you tooth and nail, when you tell them that John B. McClendon did the Four Corners, when you tell them about the secret games, they'll go after you, just like a certain person on the mouse made a comment on Martin Luther King Day. How many black Negroes came to that person to think, I'm not going to mention their name, because I might get no free advertising, but when a certain religious on Martin Luther King Day, and these Negro athletes, because they want to get them good and bad with your mouth, don't even come and say, why isn't this guy fine? That's pretty pathetic.
Yes, it is pathetic, my brother. But it's even more pathetic when people consistently are blind to the truth and then they're actually exposed to it and those who leaked it out try to shut it down. Black Magic was proof of that. Our colleague Fred Whitted was part of Black Magic. He told these people. So it's not like nobody didn't know. You know, John McClendon was the creator of the Four Corners offense. What's so difficult about saying that? That is no less difficult than saying Jan Masselinger created the machine that allowed soles to be put on shoes. Or Granville Woods created the third rail concept that allows trains even to this day to run on electricity. But you have problems with that because those people I just mentioned happen to be black. And because they're black, they couldn't possibly have done this shit. And that's where all of this comes back to, because that's what they're saying essentially. Well, you know, John McClendon was a contributor because he might have. Now, there was no might have about what Fred said. Fred said it. He said John McClendon was the person who did this before anybody else. He said it. They have it on record. They did a documentary proving this shit. And as soon as the documentary was done, it was buried. And it bothered the producer of the documentary now. This is the cat who paid the money to have all this done. The producer said, and he said this to us. We interviewed the guy. He said, I would have thought by now everybody would have known that you have to attribute the Four Corners offense to Dr. McClendon. You know, why did we go? He didn't say it out loud, but he did say, why did we go through all the trouble of making this documentary if you weren't going to reveal the truth of it all? I asked the question myself. I said, are you surprised that they've shut this down and they haven't passed on this truth? Because they keep talking about Dean Smith being the man who created the Four Corners offense. And he said yes. And he was extremely disappointed, but didn't change the fact that even when the truth was put out, that truth was not to be spoon-fed as reality to the listeners or the people viewing, because they didn't want them to. They wanted to make sure as soon as that was done, that's it. I mean, they could have had multiple discussions. They could have said, so what does this mean? Because you know they love that shit. They love that garbage. And when they want to do something organic, they steal from us. But the bottom line here is, like, you know, the whole conversation, Reggie, could have been, okay, so now we have this revelation. This comes out that it wasn't Dean Smith, but it was John McClendon who was the creator of the Four Corners offense. So where should we go with this?
Well, you know, I think we should then do what we need to do to strip that whole thing about being a contributor and make sure that everybody knows that John McClendon deserves full recognition for what he did. Now, there's nothing revolutionary about those statements, Reggie. They sound kind of factual to me. Why wouldn't you, especially after the facts have been determined? Facts kill bullshit. So every time you say Dean Smith is the creator of the Four Corners offense, you're just recycling more bullshit. And I've maintained for years that ESPN is the only company that uses bullshit as a recyclable resource. This is proof of it. So this is not some ramblings or some crazy black guy. This is the reality being spilt out there before you, and even still you want to swallow it. But I digress.
But see, this new so-called new network they're supposed to come up with the black colleges, it's going to be a joke. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a joke because, again, why are they going to go ahead and try to talk about black colleges? Well, where they get their revenue from these European schools? And I'm still trying to figure out for the life of me, why are they doing it? I mean, what are they trying to gain from it? I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. I don't buy it.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, they put us on at 1 o'clock in the morning championship game. We're supposed to go back and take it. I'm lost.
That is the point. That is the point. And what's cracking me up even more is sitting there digesting all this, that they're going to go ahead with this format that they want to call theundefeated.com. Even that's not original. The Undefeated came from a column that we utilized at Black Athlete years ago about the great Chuck Ealy, the only undefeated quarterback in college history. Doesn't matter what fucking college it was, and in the level, Chuck Ealy is the only one to go his whole entire career undefeated, untied. And he couldn't go to the National Football League because he let them know in no uncertain terms, he ain't playing fucking defensive back, fuck you. He said it nicely, but he said, fuck you, I'm not playing defensive back. He went to the Canadian Football League, won a Grey Cup there, was most outstanding player, was a rookie of the year, and he did all this good shit. So all of these things fly in the face of what's being presented as what one would call sports journalism. And to your point about this whole undefeated, you got Jason Whitlock running point man for you. Oh, yeah.
Oh, say no more.
Gonna sell. That's really going to be going to sell. Exactly. The first two words that came out of their mouths as I was listening to a promo about this thing, Colin Cowherd or whatever the fuck his name is, Oh yeah. Well, you know, he said, you know, this is like a black Grantland race, isn't it? And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Now hold on, I got an unlisted number up here, and I know if you're unlisted and you're coming out here incorrect, we're gonna put you in check. Eric, is that you?
Yeah, you know, no need to come incorrect.
Sorry, my brother. Just make it sure.
No, you got that right. You got that right. And cats, you know, are moving cloak and dagger around the pad, man. They may wonder what that red dot is that's on them.
For real. As I was saying, Eric, you're the one who passed this on to me, so I want to let you run with this because clearly the first two words out of their mouth about what they were going to do was organic. And no one, and I mean no one at the mouse has ever used that without hearing us say it first. So I digress. Carry on, please.
Well, I mean, it's more of the same. I mean, I did plug in and listen to your comments regarding, you know, the Black Magic series covering HBCUs and the prominent history it has in creating the modern-day NBA, as well as what's going on with college basketball, as well as the concept of play, as well as the concept of competition, as well as the concept of social interaction, as well for the highest and greatest good, which, again, you know, you were right on point with those particular takes. And in regards to another media outlet referring to their product line as organic and, you know, referring to their product line as the genuine article, it's just more of the delusional saying. What you have here is individuals who operate in the technosphere of idiocy. You know, we live in an era where it's all about one-upsmanship, selfies, my Facebook page with the emphasis on my Twitter page with the emphasis on my. How many hits did you get? How many followers do you have? How many friends do you have? All in the technosphere. You would never be able to gather these people in any one place, you know what I'm saying? But it's the illusion of respectability, and it's the illusion of connectivity that what you're saying is relevant due to the fact you have a certain a number of feeds that you're receiving. You see what I mean? And so when you talk about these people and they use these terminologies that you mentioned, basically they're dealing with individuals who really don't have any kind of depth. It's what you've seen recently when we discussed last in the music industry. When you see individuals borrowing from artists that they may consider to be benign or irrelevant now, you know, because they were prominent in the 70s or 60s, right. If their music was genuine, there was no computerized beats, there was no digitized music, it was genuine musicians. And they use, through technology and timers, certain breakbeats or certain hooks and repeat them with modern technology and then redub them but keep the bass article. And they feel like they're able to pull a fast one on everyone because they realize the people that they're trying to process this to have no depth of memory, have no girth of research, and really are shallow. So when individuals such as ourselves, we come in and we call them on it, they're not really want to speak into us. They're speaking to the masses, the blind. You know the old saying, in the land of the blind, the man with one eye is king. So they're just pursuing the blind. And, you know, what we say is that when you call them on it, it doesn't have to be 1,000 or 1,000,000 or hundreds of thousands of people. All it takes is one. And you say, listen, you know, this is just more chicanery. This is more usury. You're utilizing valid, true organic material, and you're trying to deplete it. These are what I call seedless fruits, you know, because seedless fruits can't reproduce themselves. So when these entities use these terminologies and feel like they're pulling one over on the masses and thinking that they're coming off elite or they're literally mimicking this vocal tones or conversations, quotations, communications, all these different scenarios that they pick up on, they feel that all of a sudden it makes them official, you know, in the land of accessibility or make them sharp. But it's just a repetitive memorandum of how shallow and how depthless these individuals really are. And so when you see this and you hear this per se, and you're able to identify, you already know that it's going to be a knockoff. You know, I mean, people are doing that all the time. You have, you know, places overseas that can take a legitimate piece of luggage that may be a high designer and almost duplicate it in total, right? And sell it, you know, way below price. And, you know, let's call it fugazi or fake. So, you know, because this is just an epidemic now. And what happens is these individuals are real good in mimicry and puppetry. They're outstanding in their ability for duplicity. Yet when you see this and hear this, it lets you know they're not the genuine article, that they may in fact be nothing but robotoids. And that's how I perceive them to be. And that's why they can never catch up to those who can bring real matter. It's, you know, in other words, you know, there's a mass of people that have never tasted, never one time have tasted real water. There's people on this planet that don't even really know what full, real hydration is, because they see something that looks like water and mimics water. They feel it's water. That's how this is where we are right now. So it's impacting culture. It's impacting thoughtology. It's impacting what's being perceived as a message. And because they can glean it through high technology and pixels, and if these pixels reveal things, these pixels can break up and fracture, and you can start seeing these people that when they break up and fracture are not really whole in human form, that they will fracture and go pixelized and show you that they are a depleted energy field. So what else can they do? They're not original. They're not original seeds, so all they can do is duplicitous work. And that's the real condemnation of what they are and what you're dealing with here. So that's why I say it's like, it's interesting to watch it, because what they do is they reveal themselves to be puppets.
That's exactly right. I've got the professor, Fred Witted, on here. And, you know, for, again, this is not just something that was rooted in angst or anger. Yeah, we're just presenting facts, and as we always say on our show, you can do with the facts you won't after we present those bad boys, because facts kill bullshit. Fact. The Professor Fred Witted was a contributor to the documentary Black Magic. Fact. He was asked about Dr. McClendon and his place in history as creator of the Four Corners Office and everything else. And I never had the chance to ask this question to you, Professor. But first off, good evening, and good evening again, Eric. Forgive my manners. But, Professor, when this thing was done, and I mean the documentary itself, did you believe in your heart of hearts, you were like, okay, we've told our own story, this is going to be good, now the word will finally get out, Dr. McClendon should get his just due?
Well, good evening, especially you, Eric. We haven't talked in a while.
Hey, what's happening, Professor? I'd like to chime into that, too, on what Michael's point. I'm going to let you go, Professor. More importantly about Black Magic, I mean, what you have here is, and what needs to be, you know, documented for you if you have first-time listeners. My father was a member of those John McClendon's three national championship teams. A starter for all three national championship teams, a member of all NAIA teams that played there, a member of the Tennessee State Sports Hall of Fame, and all those greats that lived there. So you're dealing with individuals who do the research and professorial, but more importantly, you have a living witness and historical presence of an individual actually participated in all those tournaments and featured prominently through pictures, through film, and the Black Magic film. You know, my father, James Satterwhite, is featured throughout that. And so you have a direct resource living currently as we speak right now that can just give an eloquent, living, oral factology with documentation of what actually transpired. So that's another factor involved there from the living standpoint of actual participation, and also with someone who actually went to practice the four corner office, to practice the fast break, to practice the concepts, looked at the chalk talk, looked at the chalkboards, looked at the diagrams, sat with the coach, came with the processing, shared it with his teammates, and then also was able to formulate this historical reference. So it's even deeper than that from the standpoint, because this is not fiction. This is actual participation and actualization of everything which you mentioned.
all that he said. And you know what's really sad, Eric?
Yes, sir.
Hey, I heard what you just said, but you're there hearing what you just said. Well, let's go and talk to some not so bright person. That's what I mean. Kenny Smith.
For expert analysis, yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, he's now the expert. And he ran to his defense. He did run the four corners. But it was not run to be a true offense. It was a defensive minded
keep away.
Slow things down.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, play keep away with it. Yeah, it was keep away and it's still a game and it's salt away a game. It wasn't using execution to score, it was the salt away minutes and the salt away a lead. You're right.
Exactly.
Right. Our first thing is let's get the lead, then we're gonna go to the four corners and own the ball. You know, and that is by no means what was intended for, and he was shown that. He decided that these color boys that keep coming in here with all this speed and jump on this other at the ball.
Right.
Quite possible if we keep the ball away from them, once we get the lead early, we can talk this away and make them chase us. And all we got to do when that point on is shoot free throws. So that went over like a lead below because now we have the shot clock. It says you can't hold it like that anymore. But, you know, one of the things that the Coach Mack was about, and I listened to him, it came out today, that Dean Smith I think they said it was $200 in his will per player. And, you know,
that's right.
$200
All the money he made off of them, okay. But, you know, I look at stuff like running in a passing conversation with Coach Mack, maybe 97, 98. He and I hooked up maybe 2 years before.
Uh-huh.
And we were literally working together. And we were in a meeting in Atlanta. And Coach Walker and a few other people were there. And one of the guys was an attorney, and there's a guy named Mouse, who also coached in Florida, Tennessee State. They're sitting there, and the coach said so-and-so, and he's really this stuff off like it was yesterday.
Yes.
There's so many guys he hadn't seen in decades, but he knew where they were. First of all, he knew who they were. He knew what they were doing, how they were doing, you know. And we're talking about a 90% of his ball players. And when I say 90%, I'm talking about even guys who were managers and all these kinds of things.
I saw this with Coach Gaines.
You know, it was easier for me when Coach Gaines was alive. It was a ball player and in some cases just athletes from around the campus. If you didn't know where they were, go ask Coach. Coach knew something about inside of business in the history of Winston-Salem State University. And see, if those are the kinds of things I look. You know, he ain't got nothing to do with basketball. He coached football. He knew where all his former football players were. You know,
they were co-coaches in Durham. And football. They both coached football.
So Coach McGlynn and Coach Gaines were football coaches.
Yeah, so they wore the football pants to practice. You know what I'm saying? You know when they were in North Carolina. Yes, Durham, North Carolina Central.
One of the funniest things I've ever seen was Coach Mack in football tops. He found the things, but they did not fit at all.
He was a great boxer and he was a great swimmer. So don't step to him because he knocked you out.
Swimmer extraordinaire.
Yeah.
And you know they talk about how blacks can't swim. Well, if you were black and graduated from Tennessee State after you got there, or from North Carolina College as it was at the time after you got here. You knew how to swim because that was a special education requirement. And by the way,
you call it, it is called physical education. It's not called PE. So,
correct.
You know,
he even
lifted the status of a program because everybody, we're going to take PE. No, you're going to physical education. And he let you know when you got there, so you know that, you know, there was also the physical education part, but then there was also the health. Your physical education part, if part of your health was doing the physical things, you know, and it's just a whole nipper thing that these guys
he taught a diet
were
too.
So ahead of their time.
He's way ahead. And he taught a diet, too. And individuals, you know, I can wax poetic, you know, because, you know, I mean, like I said, I mean, whatever I needed to know about Coach McLinden, I had an actual player in his glory days. Hey, you know, what do you do here? What was the concept here? What was the ideology here? What was the thought process here? What was practice like? What was the road trips like? You know what I'm saying? I mean, and so when you have that bachelor information, and what I can respect about this forum and this format, and what really caught my ear, because, you know, when Michael, you know, we talked earlier, and, you know, I plugged into the radio while I had to finish up something, and I heard him go into, you know, the four corners, this, that, and the other. And people understand, you know, the living treasures of just being able to share that information during this particular tournaments. Because when you watch these conceptual ideas of being played of these alleged so-called tempos and you start seeing the schematics, you know, I mean, Coach McLendon was way ahead of this at all times. And what transpires is why these individuals of like Chlorus, Don Chlorus, who did Black Magic, you know, some brother Sonny Hill was a key contributor, brother Earl Monroe put up some money. He's a key contributor. And when you have, you know, some other brothers as well, but I know, you know, brother Hill, brother Monroe, you know, were really impactful as well as Keith Klinkscales, you know, who was working with ESPN at the time, who did this production. He also did another feature on when Coach McLendon was at North Carolina Central, and they did The Secret Game with Duke, which was an extremely well-done production as well. It gets absolutely no light. I mean, you think Black Magic is buried. I mean,
that's
The Secret
right.
Game, it's only, I mean, I get zero light.
It is a secret.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's like, I mean, the only thing buried deeper than that, man, is the actual original artwork of the person they call Jesus, but that's another story. And when you see, you know, what that complexion looks like, my son looked a lot like us, but, you know, when you start seeing and hearing these things and the impact, It is unbelievable to a person who has this view of what 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s America was for, you know, the quote-unquote
exactly.
African-American. It is. It's absolutely astonishing, overwhelmingly mind-boggling to individuals right now to think that during this time frame, you had individuals going all the way into Kansas City, Kansas, Missouri, wherever they were. I mean, I think it was Missouri. And playing this NAIA tournament for the first time after going through a brutal stretch of the battle of the HBCUs just to participate in this thing that was orchestrated by Coach McLean because the NC2A was not going to show no love. So they created this invitational tournament, and he made negotiations with a certain individual that, you know, Tennessee State would get some love. Tennessee State A&I at the time would get love in this tournament if he was to do certain things in regards to, like, you know, what happened when he became eventually an ambassador for Converse, you know, when he went abroad and was pushing Converse and was selling, you know, and when that made him a spokesperson. At the time, Converse was just more than a sneaker company. We were like the so-called Chuck Taylor ambassadorial place for basketball, you know what I mean? So they did a lot of clinics and conventions. And Coach McLean, that's when he went overseas, and he was pushing the product and this, that, and the other. But what was transpiring during that particular time, when you start looking at that era, you start thinking about these tournaments, and you start thinking about the fact that Tennessee State, after winning these national championships, especially the first one in 57, had a bomb threat. And they had to land the plane before they got to the state of Tennessee in regards to the bomb threat. And then to go back to this tournament two straight years after bomb threats and the racism and still don't pull up on the court, still blow you out by 40, still claim that national championship, still do their trademark little team dance, you know, after the game. They had a little team dance, a little, you know, boogie that they did after it was over that was in synchronicity with the time that was unique to them, that maybe today they'd be called the Crip Walk or something. You know, but these players were executing that on the middle of the floor after winning the national championship, taking the banner, walking the center court, stretching the banner out as far as any player could see, celebrating with no fear. What matter of men were these that didn't have that fear?
Exactly.
What matter of men that went into these environments, took on these threats with this coach, conducted themselves well, got in no trouble, got to get caught, no law enforcement, weren't out at night carousing, weren't out there chasing, you know, certain entities, was following the edicts, and then went out to the court, executed business against all guys, didn't have the best locker rooms, didn't have the best situations, but had the best system. It was, that's how exceedingly well-coached they were to have all those facets in place. And to think that was that code of conduct and that bearing of person was being done by so-called uncivilized folks, right? You know, Southern Boy, whatever, and they were executing that in that environment. Those things are mind-boggling. You cannot have that publicly displayed in mass because it defeats every stereotype that ever existed, and they executed these things. You see what I'm saying? It was so the decorum, the burying, it was the pure definition of championship, and that's why it's done in the fit. And that's why all the focus became on the coach, because they realized, like, well, how's this brother bringing cats from all over the United States of America, putting them together in this stream, having them unite, like, because remember, we ain't supposed to work together, right? We're supposed to be rowdy and, you know, not be there. And have them work so efficiently and play this complex style that no one could figure out, and execute and not have any level of fear and keep coming at you regardless of what you do and say. Those are the things that are frightful to the masses about one Coach McGlinden.
Oh, yes, and those are also the things that are so insulting because, you know, we're in the sports where black men and women were doing damage. You know, C.J. Walker had established her empire. Granville T. Woods, even though he went his own way, Thomas Edison tried to pimp off him like he pimped off a Nikola Tesla.
Correct.
And stole information from him that had people believe that, well, Edison had to be the one who was inspired by all of this and not
Woods.
Actually, like, he tried to get Woods to work for him as he's supposed
and
to
George
do that.
Washington.
But I digress. Exactly. But I digress. All of this comes back to where we started with this. Professor, you had to feel, but I ain't going to say you had to. You ain't got to do nothing. But I'm sure you had to feel there was some sense of satisfaction in thinking, okay, now this story is going to get told and it's going to be presented en masse. And not only will it be presented en masse, but now the dialogue following it will ensure that this crap that they want to say regarding the doctor being a contributor will be wiped out, and they will immediately expedite the actions to eliminate contributor and call him a full-fledged member of the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Well, per a conversation with him and a couple of other people, I think he accepted his lie simply because it got him in there, but also understanding who he was. I also understand that there was a great measure of disappointment involved, but and what I'm getting at is deep down, he was not one that was going to let them define him anyway.
Uh-huh.
Understand, you know, remember, this is a man that the janitor in the gym, from what we would call an aquatic center today, the janitor had a standing order. If McGlinden swims, clean the pool.
That University of Kansas.
Dr. Naismith said, well, that's on them, not you. So, that's how he took it. Because Dr. Naismith said, well, you know, maybe cool it. No, he probably would have. But he said, no, that has nothing to do with you. And that was how, you know, you got to understand something about Coach Mack. You know, I don't know what the score is now, but I've been listening to, you know, the one of the problem being in the ACC area, everything, unless it's done by the ACC, is wrong. And I've been hearing him talking about this kid from Wisconsin who's like, he looks like he's 7 feet tall, post up on one play down the court, and another time he post up a ball pass to him. He drops it. He jumps out to the corner. Pops out to the key. Wherever he goes, knowing that none of them little post players gonna come out there and play him, and he shoots a three-pointer. Oh, that's so out of the norm. Not with post max players.
That's right.
I still remember the comments they had a recording of this at the radio station in Winston-Salem from back in the 60s. The coach that coached Jerry Sloan at Evansville. He was discussing, it was a post-game discussion of how he felt about his encounter with Earl Monroe. He says, he said the hell with Earl Monroe. He ain't do that much. And he was right. He said, listen, on one turn down the court, the center, the ball was coming out of rotation. So the ball was passed to Earl on the block. Earl passed to the outside, and then the point guard sets a pick. And the center comes out around that pick and takes the ball and shoots it. And what? The spot that he shot from today would be a three-point shot. He said, now, on the next rotation, we thought we had that covered. So on the other side pops out the power forward. Earl is still down quarter block and passing the ball. He said, Earl did in this game was basically pass the ball. The other guy killed us. And see, this is how Coach McClendon taught the game. This is why the Russians sent him this week to his funeral that said, thank you for teaching us how to play, how the game should be played. Because after Coach McClendon had been over there, if you remember anything like Olympic history, when they got the players in place to do the quality players in place to do what he told them to do, that was the year when...
72 Olympics. Yeah, remember that, though? The alleged clock malfunction and the U.S. team didn't jump for the silver medal. That was the first one they won because allegedly there was a clock malfunction. But actually, those teams leading up to that were culture. And see, that's part of the contributor core. That's part of the contributor backlash, is the fact that he went overseas and sped them up. You follow what I'm saying? So, the full-fledged honors were getting that long memories. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why they couldn't get full-fledged memory, full-fledged honors.
Yeah, see, that's one of the parts with the Hall of Fame that currently exists, because it's about Division I schools, and it's about players who play in the pros. That's just the long and short of it. Why do you think that Travis Grant is still not in the Hall of Fame after holding the scoring record for now almost 50 years?
Yep.
He's still getting screwed.
Yep. Well, what they do is go ahead, Fred.
There were several attempts to get him to transfer to a white school. I used to talk to Lucius Mitchell about that. He said, there were several attempts. He said, I saw the murder.
Yeah, him and Elmore Smith.
And he said, this was Travis Grant. Elmore Smith ended up leaving early.
But they were both Kentucky State cats, and that's when Kentucky State was winning the national championships, and they still hold records for scoring and rebounding in the NAIA, as we speak, for averages of scoring and rebounding.
These guys are still being kept out of the Hall of Fame. But, Pistol Pete is in there. Pistol Pete's dad used to drop his behind up in the book. And, I was talking to Twiggy Sanders and some other guys who lived in Raleigh. Pete would be the only white guy in the whole neighborhood in some of these places. And it's always this perception, though. He goes on, he gets beat up. He might have got hammered a little bit playing, but everybody did, playing in the hood. Because the guys who played in Charlotte say the same thing. There were white guys who went to Davidson and that type of thing. It was well, it's called UNC Charlotte now, or Charlotte now. But anyway, there were guys who were all state players in those towns who would go out and play on the block. Now, if the cops came by, the cops would tell them to leave because it was this was illegal in North Carolina. But, you know, they stayed until the cops showed up, and when the cops left, they would give him ample time, and then he'd come back, one of the things Coach Mack always said, sports breaks down a lot of barriers. And so that's what he saw with the whole thing of secret games. And if y'all have not heard, there's a move put to discredit the whole thing of the secret game. You know, basically boils down to white folks didn't see it. It didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
right. It's a word of mouth thing.
And see, the funny part is, they're trying to get those guys who are, and unfortunately, a number of them have passed away. This is why they keep public. This is why they call Coach Mack and says, "Coach, you matter. We talk about the game," because these guys were protecting him, black and white.
Yep.
You know, I remember the guy on the nightline. Says, "Well, fellas, why didn't y'all just go ahead and talk about it? Well, Coach said, don't talk about it." And there was a level of respect there was a natural respect from the black guys, but there was also a level of respect from the white guys who, because they understood. At the time this occurred, until he moved to Hampton after the 52 season, in the state of North Carolina, he was liable for arrest because, collecting whites and not when you playing together. Because that's, not because anything was quote unquote wrong. It wasn't like they never played before. But they did do this like that because this was how the state was. You know, people talk about Duke University. You could go to Duke University as a student if you were black, if you were a member of the United Methodist Church. You just couldn't, because of North Carolina, you could not stay on campus. So very few of us went there. But at the same time, though, when you have to look at all the things that this man endured and overcame, there's no way to measure him because the first thing you do is wrong in thinking about Coach Mack was, oh, he's a little fella. And you never know little things like Eric said, he could knock you out.
He's very revolutionary. He comes in with a velvet hammer. And, that was part of, when it's all said it's over, it's kind of like you never know you were in the Sting until you get busted, right? Like when Marion Barry was firing up the pipe, he didn't know he was in the Sting. You know what I'm saying? He thought, he was in apartheid, right? You don't know you're part of a Sting until, that thing manifests. And what transpires is, when they bring up the cameras, oh my goodness, they roll out and they come with them handcuffs, well, it's a Sting. And it's what you had was someone who spent their entire career and they didn't realize it was a Sting until it was all over. And when they started adding up all the accounts and historical things, that took place, it was like, whoa, we better take it. You know what I'm saying? We've been fleeced. And so the last leg of the fleece job is to not give full honors. You see what I'm saying? Like, you fleeced us enough. You fleeced us so good, all we can do is do this. And that was a certain understanding about that because these were pinpoint strategies. Had Coach McGlennon been a politician or a president, man, he would have been phenomenal because he was really making a lot of political moves, but he did it with a velvet glove. But underneath that was social and reengineering. It was to try to make certain things impact, and he was using sport, but he also loved the science of the game. He loved the science part of the game. He loved the mathematics of the game. He loved the semantics of the game. He loved taking an individual in and morphing them within that, underneath their uniqueness, and then blending it into a certain course. So it took a certain level of understanding about physiology, mental concepts, how to blend it back. He had to understand backgrounds when he recruited, you know, what which buttons to push. He had a phenomenal understanding of persona. You know, I had conversations with him one time, in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, Elizabeth City State University. And he had just come back from China. And we were sitting down, and some of his conceptual ideas, it was unique, it was fresh. And, me being, at that time, a real avid, sports fan, especially basketball, and understanding those concepts, I just found some of those takes and those analysis just precise. And it was a different kind of a conversation I had, regarding basketball that wasn't really the same old speed on statistics and other stuff. It was a little really insightful, really sparked my mind to go further into those particular developments and to look at, constructs of players a little bit differently. It was all those things that took place. It was all those things. And when you start talking about P.E., which Fred mentioned, and you start talking about, Dr. Naismith, he was one of the cons of those people from the 20s and the era. They called that physical culture. They didn't call it P.E. It was called a physical culture. That was the word they used, was physical culture. And the game was created for physical culture to try to create more of a athletic person, out of the male populace, that Mason got assigned to, hence he came with the game of basketball. A lot of those came out of a lot of Native American concepts, ideas, because they had a sports complex, and plus the fact that, Coach McGlynn was part Native American. And so you had these conceptual ideas that was brought into play that had a little more depth than what was the average. All those things combined and how we discuss it here can never reach the discourse, because whatever coach you mention in current parlance, I don't care, NBA, DE, RBAC, Wooden, whomever, and these so-called modern-day coaches or whatever, current-day coaches, I won't call them modern-day coaches, current-day coaches, none of them have that depth that we're talking about.
That's right.
In terms of these understandings and how to blend it. Therefore, you have to bury individuals because it's too intimidating. All these people love basketball. I mean, basketball rakes in trillions of dollars in every part of its concept, be it a pickup, be it youth leagues, senior leagues, adult leagues, women's basketball. I mean, buying memorabilia, cats walking around with jerseys or whatever. I mean, it generates trillions of dollars. But what, out of all that going on, Naismith is the rightful credit for putting it in play in terms of creating something for physical culture. None of these individuals were directly taught by him other than Coach McGlendon that made an impact in coaching. That in itself is something worth burying for these individuals. They can't even deal with that one.
No shit.
That's like, Michael, that's like saying for someone who's a highly religious person and whatever their faith may be, and they can actually say that, through their generations they sucked at the feet of that so-called prophet.
Yeah.
I mean, that puts you in a whole other categorical design out of all these individuals. I mean, see, Coach McGlendon, because of these relationships and because he actualized these things and because he did it, and to Fred's viewpoint, he didn't need the rah-rah sis kumba.
Exactly.
He didn't need the rah. He didn't need that crap, because what he wanted to do was change the playing field, and he was so successful in doing it. And then when it got down for him to want to actually coach and actually, participate based on his experience, be he an NBA coach or a Division I collegiate coach, that regardless of the college, because a coach wants to coach, right? I mean, I'm certain the brothers here, Mike, you're really down with football. I'm certain that it may have been a point in time that someone's, a concert said, hey, Mike, we want you to coach Dartmouth University. You'd be strapping up the clipboard, bringing up the film tape. You wouldn't be caring to coach a little Mikey McGillicuddy from High Point, Canada. You're just a coach. You're just going to do your thing and see if your concepts could be part of the spirit of competition. And that's what happened to Coach McGlendon. He wanted to get back out there and just be a coach, but because of the historical fleece, he felt he pulled one over that was not going to be allowed, because they realized, hey man, this guy ain't the one, man. He will fleece you with a smile and a velvet hammer, and you won't know you got fleeced until 20 years after the fact. That's how they looked at him, and then from there, everything he did had an agenda as opposed to it being genuine.
It's true, and the same can be said for Big House Games. The same can be said for Coach Gaither and for Coach Rob. And these are the type of people that they didn't want to deal with, because
yeah, they would smile at them and let them know, you know you're not better than me. You know you had to come to me for the knowledge, and you just have to live with that. So sad on your ass. But as I say this, as I say this, what your argument so skillfully lays out in front of everybody is, how in Southwest hell can a so-called sports organization say that what they're going to put out is organic when they've spent so much energy trying to suppress the truth even once it came out? You can't tell me with a lie and then take that truth, take a little bit of truth out of that and try to make it a truth. A lie is a lie no matter what happens. And truth is truth no matter what happens. So now here, the undefeated is going to try to tripe out in front of y'all, and y'all swallow it as gospel when you take your little trip to the little black world, which ain't even going to be part of their whole world, because they know we're going to use this as a pacifier. This is a panacea. Because when we're done and you come out of black world, well, we're going to subject you to the same shit we've been known for passing on to you all the time. And we're going to make sure that Junebug, if he took a chicken sandwich that he wasn't supposed to take, we will rake his black ass over the coals, and no one will be none the wiser. But, of course, you know, you'll remember that, well, we were undefeated for about an hour. No, we stay undefeated 24/7, 365 here, bitch. So you can let that shit marinate for a little bit. And I throw Cowboy Reggie back in here. Cowboy, I know you've heard some of this. So, again, because you do have a stake in this as well as everybody, you being down in that neck of the woods, you would have thought that Coach McClendon would have been given full credit for everything. And if this entity proclaims to be so hip to putting out real information for everybody, they would have told y'all this. We wouldn't have had to be in a position to say this because they'd have been first out front with the trumpets blazing and everything. But the fact that these motherfuckers suppress this speaks to the bigger issue, that no matter how many black people they may have employed there, they don't have anybody who really is black in terms of understanding. You can't do this. They don't speak up at production meetings. They don't say anything. They let them do whatever the fuck they are because they'll tell them, nigga, don't you say a motherfucking thing. Shut up and collect your check.
Well, my whole thing is that I don't know how much TNA Smith makes, but now, if you notice, Eric, check out how he's doing commercials now. Now, Saturday Night Live do this little skit with him. But see, again, what troubles me is that, again, when you have certain individuals, and I got to go here, just talking about that piece of filth known as Empire, and they are enriching those same bastards that sit up there and perpetuate that, hey, you Negroes are a bunch of animals like Mr. Byrne, need to be dealt with, need to be put down. You're not human. And the sad part about it is that we enrich these same people that go after us from a psychological point of view. Just like Dr. Francisco Swenson, I had to do with her ISIS paper and again the curse theory. They are so upset because they didn't get the blessing. They are so upset, but they didn't get what they know they want. And the sad thing about it is that they do everything they can because when President Obama was elected, that killed that myth that, hey, we are superior and they are inferior.
Well, see, yeah, Reggie, here you just brought up something, because here's their organic. Their organic is, we resent you, black. We resent you, black motherfucker.
No, we
resent the fact that we have to deal with you because we really don't want to. Even though we tried to take you and get as much out as we can from you, the bottom line is, this shit don't go on unless you're involved. We have to have you. So we're trying to... We have to control as much of this as possible, and we really don't give a fuck about you. We'll throw something out there to appease some of you niggas out there, but the bottom line is, this is our show, and we're going to control it. You're going to believe in us because we're going to tell you what's going on. It's not even about the event anymore. It's not about who's on the football field. It's not about who's on the basketball court. It's about us telling you what it's about. We're going to tell you that we'll dictate this for as long as we can get away with it, and that's what you all are going to swallow, and you're going to love it. And I'm here to tell you, we don't play that here. So the bottom line in all of this is that they're organic. The organic matter comes strictly from a whole different place, and it's got nothing to do with the so-called material they want to put out. Exactly. It's a word.
It's a weapon of words. And what happens is individuals, you know, I mean, we could spend a whole discourse on the power of words. Individuals have no idea that power. And on top of that, it's kind of interesting because, you know, we talked about this in the past. I mean, there's technology right here, right now, accessible. I mean, no problem. Where you can actually listen to a person's voice, rant through an analyzer, and hear them lie. Any politician, any person, boy, he may have a little something like that, but keeping it moving, you have these things right now where if you are, you know, someone in the know, you know, with some real brevity in this society and really in synchronicity with what's really coming down technologically, not technologically gadgetry, right, to keep you enslaved, technologically for your personal advancement and enhancement, then you can, then they can just come in here right now, take this show, everything we just said in the last 20 minutes, run it through that and go, okay, this is 100. This is coming from the heart. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And then it's dead. And then they'll leave it alone. You see what I'm saying? So in other words, those who know the real deal, right? They know where it's, they know it's organic. They know it's 100. These other individuals who come on with these scripts and these productions and a part of these ad-libs, you know, environments, and then just kind of recycle what we discuss and what we talk about. We already talked about that. That's a form of knockoff. And I mean, and as far as these idiot shows, I mean, listen, we survived Good Times and Sanford and Son and What's Happening, Two Sevens, and all this crap like that. That's all part. Yeah, I mean, it's all part for the course. But I mean, come on, man. I mean, I'm not looking at my, you know, the quote unquote panties in the bunch behind that kind of crap. You know what I'm saying? Taraji and Terrence Kent, they're Hollywood nominated actors and actresses. They can't get a real movie gig. I guess they got to go slumming somewhere. You know what I mean? So we start looking at, you know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? We start looking at these conceptual designs. It still comes down to one thing, not having the formats to do these productions, not having the formats to create these scenarios where you do your own diatribe. So by virtue of having the impact in alternative media and having the impact in all these different forums you can have impact in, all these different televisions and all these different networks and things of that matter, what even a crap show like the so-called Empire does is, even though in our so-called worst moments, it still busts rating records because of the utter fascination. You can't. So back to your point, Michael, even to that point, you can't get around it. So you can look at it two ways and say, you know what, it's 100% fiction. It's a crap TV show. Art does not imitate life here, okay? It's a crap TV show. But the point of the matter is, it crushed every kind of TV rating, per se, because of that utter affiliation and attraction to these conceptual ideas of what goes on in this unique realm and its unique product. So, again, to your point, we see the same thing will transpire with, you know, the community colleges in California and, you know, trying to move junior college children, you know, junior college students to HBCUs, you know what I mean? Because the California system is in the way they're structured, the junior college, the Cal system, you know, the senior to the UC Santa Cruz, the Cal Berkeley, the UCLA, SCs, this whatever, they are overran, right? Because the largest junior college system in America is in California. So you have a whole apostasy of students that need a place to go. So you have to relax the out-of-state, you know, fee, because the out-of-state fee is pretty high. You know, when you go to see, so that was really, all these things are impacted. So what happens is, no matter how they define it, they cannot stop all the progress. You follow? So progress is not measured, like Coach McGlinden would do it, where progress is not measured with this overwhelming nuclear holocaust. You wake up one morning and everything's black. You follow what I'm saying? And everything's black.
Exactly.
Yeah, we want this Armageddon of, oh, right, we wake up the next morning and next thing that we got, you know, 12 people are Caucasian. Yes, boss, sir, how can I service you? I mean, you know, we're looking at this total flipology, but it's already has manifested itself in so many different other ways, right? So, the key to the point, when you start seeing these networks and these institutions wanting to create their so-called genre or their new form of black exploitation movies. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they're coming out with their, you know, they're coming out with a new Black Caesar, you know what I'm saying? And a new, you know, what's that Jim Brown, joint, you know, Truck Turner, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, they're coming out with, you know, the Glenn Turman joints. You know, the Glenn Turman was in the Spook who sat next to the door joints. So we got the fat Spook who sat next to the sports door coming out with his organic version.
Well, you know, it's one thing. Let's go to somebody who's been in the belly of the mouse. And that is our colleague and editor emeritus of the Black Athlete Sports Network, Tony McLean. Tony, I think you can see where the conversation is going here, sir. So rather than have anyone speculate on this, you know, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here, but clearly your old employers are. So first of all, good evening. And give us some mouse mindset into what they think they're going to be putting down with this nonsense that they call the undefeated.
Well, it's no different from Viacom's white man's version of BET. You know, it's no different from what you see in a lot of these allegedly black mediums who are run by white folks.
Huffington Post, AOL.
You know, they'll throw us a few bones, you know, so
TV more.
We had Byron Allen on our show earlier this week talking about his lawsuit.
It was great too.
And you know, we're basically fighting for our lives here now. You know, because between Comcast and Time Warner and AT&T and DirecTV and everything else, they want to usurp the message. You know, we always have to go back to what Fred Wynn has always said. We have to tell our own stories. We cannot allow our enemies to tell our story.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And all the more reason why you have to dismiss what the mouse is trying to do here with undefeated. Now, again, you know, they may have, dare I say, good intentions, but no, it's with them, their good intentions will get the face slapped out of your mouth in most places. But again, the main thing I always try to strive, and especially going back to what, you know, Roland, our late CEO, Roland Rogers, said years ago.
I said,
at the end of the day, we are celebrating the past, present, and future history of athletes of color. We don't need to qualify anything. We don't need to be afraid to call ourselves Black Athletes, the Black Athlete Sports Network. All we have to do is just tell the stories. The history is there. You know, if you don't know about, you know, John B. McClendon, shame on you. If you don't know about Jake Gaither, shame on you. If you don't know about Marshall Taylor, the great cyclist who predated Lance Armstrong, shame on you. Because it was always funny to me, we would always get most of our hits during the month of February, surprise, surprise. And, you know, I would always tell folks, you know, we're not just here in February. We're here all the time. Now, you choose to come here in February and you're sort of enlightening yourself. But, you know, if you really want to learn something and you really want to find out what's really going on, you'll come back here in March, in April, in May, in June, and all year round. Put it this way. If you only feel the need to come visit me in February, I don't want to see you the rest of the month.
That's exactly right. So when we see this throwdown, this sham present it in front of everybody. We know some people will drink because some folks just don't know no better. But the fact that they've got to go somewhere to get this organic material leaves the possibility of mental death. And I say this, follow me on this here. As I say this, in Canada right now, they're making up this drug, fentanyl. Fentanyl is essentially greenies that we used to take back in the day, whatnot, for pain when we were playing ball and all that shit. But these are greenies to the nth degree. The activating ingredient in what makes this stuff lethal is that you can take a macro milligram of this stuff. And it will not just cause the desired effect, but it can cause your death. But when they make street versions of this, because the science is so inexact, you can take 9 or 10 macromilligrams of this stuff, and it's enough to kill you. And that's what's being put out there. That's what the mouse is doing. It's trying to kill as many minds as they possibly can, because you don't know whether they put a 3 on the horseshit that they're trying to present to you, or whether they put a 10 on it, or whether this stuff is so highly pure that they don't even know what the fuck to do with it, so they try to carve it up and make it come out as palatable, and yet it still destroys because of the so inexact science of trying to determine what black people say and think, even when they use black people as their guinea pigs to do so. Am I making sense here?
What you're dealing with is what Tony, you know, coins, you know, and always, you know, stuck with me, you know, talking to him in the past, is you're dealing with revisionist history. And you're dealing with individuals who want to rewrite the books. And what transpires is that's totally flipped, because now individuals are pushing back and bringing out great, you know, quote-unquote African-American writers like Sam Lacy from years past. You follow what I'm saying? They never got any light. Phil Nunn Jr., seniors. I mean, they never received any light.
Yeah, they're going to talk about them.
Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? They never received any light by virtue of what we talk about here all the time historically. You know, I mean, what I post up, you know, on, you know, websites, old photos, you know what I'm saying, 50s photos of individuals that show this in historical context. Now, everywhere you go, people are pulling up 1930s photos. Oh, he played his great-grandfather, Brian Millicent, you know,
exactly.
He was an Olympic swimmer in 1920. Then they got the photo, then they bring you the current day event, how his legacy goes on in their family fabric. You got a story about this back? Sure, Bob. Brian Millicent, his father is now the head coach of such and such in the Sweet 16 for the first time. They go follow a long family tradition of sports excellence. They never covered it like this, all by virtue of what we discussed here, because the problem is that the historical impact is so rich and it's so thick and it's so undisputed that it's literally a fantasy if you could not be able to document it. And now we live in an era where you can document it. I can pull up, I can find me a 1927 newspaper with a Negro League box score. You know what I'm saying? And find that name. And I can find that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's no problem. And there's research teams that can do that. So you can no longer not dust off the facts. You know, Smithsonian, museums all across the world are showing their historical relevance. And you can, from your living room or wherever you may be, coffee shop, what have you, pull up all this information at your fingertips if you know how. You can go to the Library of Congress. You go to the Smithsonian. Now, you can't dust these things off. What's transpired and what we do here and what, you know, what Brother Gray's written about, what you've talked about in terms of this cat from Toledo that played quarterback. Y'all remember the story? The brother in Canada, you know what I'm saying, that, you know, Marcus Allen's brother did all these records, and my brother, Professor Fred, talks about. We're just doing things like Fayetteville history. Like, what, Fayetteville history? What is that about? North Carolina high school, great black basketball. What is Fayetteville about? You know, I mean, so when you start, you know, black magic, when you start dusting this stuff off and making it concurrent, it ties into what Tony McClain just mentioned about, you know, my main man, Brother Roland Rogers,
you know, amongst the elders, you know what I'm saying, peace and blessings be upon him. I mean, in our dialogues, you know what I'm saying, he would articulate, I love the courage, you know, that he had, you know, and the fact, because, you know, it's hard for me to walk, I always say it's hard for me to walk with cats with my courage, you know what I mean, because, you know, I mean, sometimes I may have a little too much, you know, but Warren Rowland, I loved it. You know, he was talking about certain things like, well, you know, past, present, future is one. And see, so when we merge these stories, allegedly, be they oral or factual, because in our culture, we did oral histories. That's what mystifies these other good people, because we have this oral tradition. You follow what I'm saying? That we can go into our own archives. It's called DNA. You know, now they start talking about how you can plant, like, you know, 100,000 years of information in one DNA strand, right? So when you do oral history, you're supposed to be able to capitulate that if your mind's not too screwed up and pull from those archives at your will, because it's within you. I mean, that's a whole science within itself. We understood that sacred science. Oh, they're getting spooked out, now we're talking this way, Mike, so let's spook them out. So that thing being said, you see what I'm saying? So that thing being said, we have all this at our disposal. And what we do, we don't do it to say from a better than perspective, you know, like, oh, we're better than you, or, you know, we're going to show you crap.
You don't have to.
Right, exactly. It's done from that perspective. It's done from the perspective that we remember, and see, the honor in remembering has been lost. And what these people are doing when they start talking about this organic stuff or start utilizing all these other great sages in the past and all these great writers, you know, I won't talk about it tonight, but I ended up getting a book written by this great African-American writer, you know, who used to write for the Los Angeles newspaper when it's relevant in the 50s. No, you know, whatever that news was. The Sentinel, I believe it may have been. The Los Angeles Sentinel, I don't recall.
Brad Pye?
Yeah, was it the Sentinel? Okay. And I bought a book, you know, online from, you know, some, you know, exotic book. You know, when I bought this book, it was written in 1969. It's never been read. It came like brand new. Mm-hmm. I leafed through the pages, and this thing, the pages are so crisp, I might get a paper cut, because this is when they were using real paper, where you got a paper cut, and you turn the paper.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how crisp. I can't believe no one has ever read this friggin' book, or touched, or maybe even opened it, and it's just incredibly enriching information that talks about our past. Again, when we start putting all this stuff together, we don't need to share this right now, because we have all these adversaries who have the resources to try to out-archive us and out-do these things and out-electrify us. So I'm not going to give them no ammo for that. That's going to come and pass with these radio things we're putting together, some other stuff. But in terms of the enriching information, I mean, it's literally, and I say this without any hesitation, it's almost scriptural. In its richness, in its depth, and in its true amazing format. Because we have the reason of ability now to understand how truly amazing. I look at this, and and there's no hesitation. I mean, I see some of the great feats that took place amongst our ancestors in this present day, right here in the soil of North America, as pretty much mystical.
And, Mike, I want to say one thing. Breaking news right now is Kentucky 44, West Virginia 18. And the reason I'm saying this score, because I said God bless Hampton when they were out there and they weren't intimidated at all. And I have to say, man, there's some brothers on that Kentucky squad that appreciate history, because in my opinion, West Virginia shooting their mouths off, and they just mugged one brother. One brother went up and two brothers gave him a sandwich. So I'm just saying, it's nice to see that some young brothers know the history, which I think begs to what we're talking about when it comes to black magic, because it did show, in my opinion, respect in Hampton. Just my opinion.
And Mike, just to piggyback still on Eric,
please.
You guys know how much I love the Negro Leagues, and
right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
When I grew up, you know, I bought, just being young and stupid, I bought into the myth that there wasn't information out there and that, you know,
hard to find back then, man.
Anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's absolutely, positively no way you can say that there isn't information out there. There's been tons of books written,
tons.
Great, great, you know, photos.
Tons. understand, the Elias Sports Bureau, who is the sports, you know, the official statisticians of, you know, all the four major sports, they had a contract with the Negro Leagues. It's just that they didn't do things as thorough as they would Major League Baseball, because again, it played into the whole thing of, well, if the information's out there, then people will get, you know, because see, again, this is not something that's just happening. They have been trying to usurp us for years. This is not the story, is so great,
T-Mac. I mean, what it is, you know, the story, it lines are just so enriching, phenomenal. I mean, literally. I mean, if you base the depth of the storylines on what they present now today as a story, oh, well, you know, little Jed Leroy, you know, he escaped a crack in Bayern and a gang relationship. And while his mother was, you know, pimping on his corner, his father was doing a bid, you know what I mean, for a homicide, for pimping and panhandling. You know what I'm saying? I mean, and look how he came through these main streets. Tell us, little Leroy, how'd you do it? Well, I just kept my focus, man, you know. I just kept my head on the street, man. I was keeping it 100, man. You know what I mean? Now I'm here, man. I've got the big, you know what I'm saying? And so they have all these perpetuities. You see this in the clowning of, you know, one Floyd, you know, Mayweather, you know, and you see this in the fact that, you know, I mean, this guy did a bid, right, you know, for mishandling a female in his family, this, that, and the other, but he maintained his title. He didn't get stripped like an Ali and these kind of cats like that. But you had cats like Sugar Ray Robinson, who, based on the economic impact of what he was doing in his era, would make Floyd Mayweather look like a lily. You follow what I'm saying? And then, you know, he was tapping it within his community. But we don't hear about Sugar Ray Robinson being, like, one of the greatest cats right now that, you know, and Floyd couldn't hold his jock strap, you know, a cat like Sugar Ray Robinson. And I ain't mad at Mayweather for being in a position of how he's been pimped to be nowadays, do you? But what I'm saying is, when you look at our historic complex and you start looking at the Henry Armstrongs, you know, those brothers at that weight class and what they were able to do and how phenomenal of fighters they were, I mean, these cats were actually doing martial arts with boxing gloves, you know, these conceptual ideas, when you start looking at that and dusting it off and you start going and pulling it in, we start bringing these stories forward, when we start communicating about these things, it dampens the revisionists, right? Because now the revisionists can't claim, you know, this is the best player they ever seen. You know, this guy, every play is great. Every play is phenomenal. And they quote triple doubles. I mean, I always talked about the skewing of basketball. I want to say it one more time. You have two different field goal percentages for a field goal. Someone has a three-point shooting percentage, and then anything within the arc is a field goal percentage. How is that different? So obviously you got you're creating a statistical design for this fictitious thing behind the arc. Anything within the arc is another type of percentage. And Chamberlain one time was doing this, and he had one of this incredible statistician that was a longtime stat person way back from the Philadelphia Warrior days in the 50s. I forgot his name, escapes me.
I think about that, T-Mac.
And he had him. To this day, he's still out there doing stats, right? I mean, he's like one of them. He's like one of them dudes. Like, man, you know, can I just sit down? Can I just sit with you and just show me a random 1966 Celtics, you know, Celtics 76er scorecard, right? I mean, I can glean a lot of information from that handwritten piece. You follow what I'm saying? By just looking at it. And so that being said, he was talking about, like, you know, when Jordan was, they were hyping Jordan, and they were talking about how many times does he actually shoot a perimeter shot in the three-point arc, or is 80%. So the guy did the stats were like 75% of his stuff was like 5 feet and in, and the rest was out. And he was like, well, how can this guy be considered this great player scorer when he's manipulating the stat guidelines of how the stat guidelines were created? And then Wilt made the ultimate statement when he said, you know, when I played, they changed the rules to, you know, hold me back. When he played, they changed the rules for him to get off. So how can you make a comparison and say he's greater when you don't bring in these conceptual designs about what players? And so these analytic people just totally supersedes their mindsets. because they can't get into the minutia of the flavor of that particular game, per se, because you would have to go to the archives and pull that out, and you just can't write it off as they say now, well, we just don't have the stats for that. We don't have the film for that.
Yeah, Eric, I'm so glad you said that. I'm so glad you said that, Eric, because as we speak, the book Four Quarters of Soul is being finished, and I know the professor will
tell us about
this.
Four Quarters of Soul. What kind of book is that, Mike? What's Four Quarters of Soul about?
We are telling truths and telling our own stories as it comes to those players who came from historically black colleges and universities who, by the impact of their play back in the day, merit induction into the American and Canadian Football Halls of Fame. Some are already there, but too many stories have not been told, and Brother Fred and I have been mining gold for the last few weeks. But here's what I'm going to lay on Fred, because Tony just mentioned statistics earlier. Now, we know when the USFL won their case against the National Football League and was summarily disbanded, the AFL not only kept stride with the NFL, but they were putting on a superior brand of ball. So the NFL had no choice but to capitulate, because they had ripped their asses twice in a row with teams with strong HBCU rosters, especially the Kansas City Chiefs, who had put so many brothers from HBCUs on the field that Minnesota still is looking to see which way is up, because they still got their ass whipped as badly as they did. People forget that the Minnesota Vikings, just like the Baltimore Colts, were double-digit favorites against the Kansas City Chiefs. And, of course, you know, forget about the Joe Willie and all that other old bullshit. You know, well, you know, they got a retread quarterback who was a bench warmer in the National Football League. How can they beat us? All the niggas in there, oh, we know how y'all beat us, Joe. Got your ass whipped. And those stats had to come, every stat had to come from the American Football League and be incorporated with National Football League stats. Now, remember, you got to understand the significance of this. The NFL was the establishment league. They had standing orders for all of their beat writers to not talk about the American Football League, especially after Kansas City whipped that ass in Super Bowl IV. It was a moral imperative, and this is another reason why Four Quarters of Soul is important, because all those players who were stars back then, all of those players who made the AFL what it was, never mind the fact that, you know, Dernier got recognized and Buchanan got recognized because they won a championship team, but players like Clem Daniels and others who also made it easier for National League players who were from HBCUs, like Howell Jackson. Their stories are going to be put out there in front of everyone, and those statistics you can't argue with. So there's going to be a whole shitload of good shit coming down the pike, and like that person who had a problem with all these black people being cast in TV shows, well, you may have a real problem with this, because there's a whole lot of brothers going to be cast in this one.
It's damn Negroes in them fields.
But that issue.
What everybody speaks to miss with all this, you know, there's always been this question. Well, how can we substantiate that Jake or Cook Rob or Big House or any of them color coaches was all that good? Two things I look at. Go to Florida. Take just the All-Americans out of Florida and put them on one team. They call them the Rattlers. Because remember, back in them day, those best guys from Florida couldn't go to, well, Florida. Let's totally set the record straight.
Yes, sir.
In 1947, there were no males at Florida State. Florida State was Florida Women's College. So you can imagine what kind of great football tradition they had at an all-girls school.
In Seminole country, in the heart of the Seminole Nation, because the Seminole Nation, black native tribes, which primarily were the Seminoles, even to this day, you see Sister Mary, man, there's a Rwanda, she'll kick you in there, she'll say, my name ain't Rwanda, my name is Black Eagle, you know what I'm saying? So this was the heart of Seminole Nation as well, Brother Frederick. Go ahead, bro, I'm sorry.
But, you know, the whole problem is there's this effort among the quote-unquote elitists to rewrite history and all these other things. And in rewriting, it's always to rewrite in their favor. The problem is when you rewrite in somebody's favor, you tell a lie to perpetuate a lie that continues to come out to be a lie. And because of that, you end up with manure, all kinds of things. And see, we have not done a good enough job of telling our story yet, because I'm telling y'all something that I mentioned to a group that did Black History Month. I said, this whole thing about documentation, Eric hit the nail on the head. You know, the Griots didn't write nothing down. You learned the story and you told the story right every time. If you didn't tell it right, they killed you. You pass it on and you didn't change and you didn't editorialize. You just did your job. You know, and when you go back and look at those things that were the foundations of our community, you know, I had a guy tell me one time, African guy says, son, can you explain to me about documentation? And this was an African PhD. He says, where we come from, if your word don't mean nothing, screw what you write down.
Your word is
wrong.
That's right.
Your word has to be your bond. And, you know, as long as you get the facts right, that's all that matters. And I'm so appreciative of him, you know. Well, sadly, you know, he's gone now, but I think there are times I don't get to you. But even to the white guy, we called him, we used to call him Jack, all kind of crazy stuff. But, you know, Cool the Fool was a white guy. He, you know, he admitted some of the things. Okay, he says, you know, this is what you do to be grammatically correct and to be in proper standing with all the stuff that you got to go through when it comes to being correct for your English class. But at the same time, you know, facts are facts and you can't fool with facts. And if, you know, just, you know, do enough of that to get by with once you get past these classes. But as long as you know that what you're saying is factually correct, don't worry about it. Move with it. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that I've done. You know, I have actually had the pleasure of reading the black newspapers going all the way back to all the way back to 1904. If you've ever read a pre-World War II black newspaper, you'll know there is no such thing as the sports section. A few of them had the sports page. It was anywhere from page 12.
It could be anywhere. Page 1.
You know.
That's right.
You know, it said like it was like certain games were going to be in a certain place. But beyond that, shoot, it was wherever. You had to go through all the way through the paper, or you just had to come in until 1935.
Right.
Oh, no, you just can't just catch Keen as they say in wrestling terms. But, you know, no matter how good we are doing in telling our story, and I think, you know, I was so blessed. It was almost 2 weeks ago. I met with a young lady who is likely to be one of my first mentees when it comes to the whole thing of writing and telling stories and stuff, because when I look at the kinds of things that our kids are being exposed to, you know, I'll be 61 years old come August. So I'm correcting, I will be 62 years old come August. So, you know, it's time to, beyond time to start, you know, sitting her, you know,
impart the wisdom.
Now, yeah, I mean, you got to pass it on. And that's,
right.
That's what we have not done a superior job.
No.
We need to do that. You know, all of us as adults, and I won't even get into who the youngest among us, but it's not even important. We're all at an age where we need to be moving to that next level, if not
That's
the next
right.
two level, because we're so far behind with this stuff that we need to bear down and get this kind of stuff out there. You know, I don't get into this thing, as bad as I'd like to slap the hell out of Stephen A., I'm not going to do that. There are a few others out there I'd like to smack the hell out of. I'm not going to do that because Coach Mack didn't, you know, things I didn't know that are, you know, by all rights, should have known. Coach Mack never hit me other than, you know, as Eric will tell you, he could hit you between the ears and not put a hand on you.
It was a challenge to your character. It was a spark. And what you're talking about, all you need to do is hit that flame. And it's gonna once the spark's lit, it's gonna go forever. So you don't have to be this, like we talked about, this big bonfire, you know, this big massive explosive thing. Never moves like that. It's never cataclysmic like that, you know. It's always, you know, I mean a Dixie cup full of the 0-point energy that permeates this planet could explode this planet 40 times over. And I'm talking about a Dixie cup full of energy. If you're a walking component of that energy, you're a walking component of stardust, and everyone I'm talking to is that. You know what I mean? You have that capacity. All it has to do is be activated. See, it's all about the spark. And what these brothers are doing, like Coach McGlinden, what I would try to do as a coach would just spark it, or even as a parent, or even as an elder, or even in these conversations. It's just creating the spark. How the person runs with it and interprets it is on them at that point. You know what I'm saying? At that point, I can run with it because I've been sparked. I mean, the people that I look back on that were inspiring me, they were just sparking me. Hey, you need to go look at that. Hey, you need to go over here and check this out. You got a minute? Look at this. Oh, yeah, I want to run something by you. All these things were just flint. You know what I'm saying? They were just little pieces of flint. And I would just use it, boom, the next thing you know, boom, forest fire. And to the whole thing that you're talking about in terms of the oral history, now, when you go to places and you start looking at ancient cultures, and be it in this country, be it, you know, Native Americans, or be it, you know, in Mexico, you push it further, you look at the Olmec cultures, you know, the big stone heads, those African features down there. I mean, the Olmec, the what they call the rubber people, this thing that they still can't explain who, what, and where they were. This and another. You know, they can't crack the codes of the oral traditions. I mean, there's certain sciences, like the sciences of Kemet, you know, what people call Egypt, where the only way you can even enter these places in certain areas is through mental means. You cannot penetrate it physically. It's only through mental means. And so when you start looking at some of the reliefs that people use, the Greek term hieroglyphics, what about that is oral? What about that? It's all pictograms. You see what I'm saying? So you have to be a certain kind of intelligentsia, and you have to have a certain kind of brain power just to even format what the thought process and the message of being conveyed is. It's the same thing in oral tradition and talking about within our cultures and talking about certain things about the griots. There's a lot of power there. What it has been good is that there are bookkeepers and there are accountants and there's those who do those things. The greatest bookkeepers of some of our historical impacts of the past, because that's their culture where they can keep things secretive and not really move upon it, is like what you'll call in the ancient Chinese cultures, right? Because they have a long documented recorded history of some of our greatest feats, and you know how to decode them. They're all there. So it's points of references for us as fact-finding storage messages. They're found everywhere if you're able to decode it and not get caught up in genre and terminologies of what people define people to be. It's like if you see Sammy Sosa, I see a black man. Another person says, I see a Dominican. You know what I'm saying? I heard he ain't black no more, but you know what I'm saying.
Exactly.
You know, you have these situations. So when you start documenting what Brother Fred's talking about, and you start putting these stories, they're all facts. I mean, these things are factology, and the fact you can bring them to light, you have to prove they're not facts. I'm of the viewpoint where prove it isn't. you say that I need to do this. Well, you need to prove to me that it isn't. See, that's the problem that can't
exactly.
be. You can't prove right. that it isn't true. It's your, if you say it's not true, then it's your course of reference to prove that it's not.
Mm-hmm. That's the key to tying in everything with Jackie Robinson. God bless him, because he sacrificed his body for the culture, whether it was for good or for bad. Because if somebody had said exactly what Eric said back then, prove to me that the Negro Leagues aren't superior. The Negro Leagues
were superior.
They were superior. So the fact that somebody had to be so screwed in the head to believe that because they were going to play in the white baseball leagues, they were going to a better brand of ball. When they played against these guys, barnstormed against them with their ass, and knew that for every Joe DiMaggio or Dizzy Dean who saw how great they were to say, yeah, we need these guys, none of them would have the balls to say they're playing a better brand of ball over there.
And my check this one out, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If this is baseball, prove to me that the state, prove to me that you can find, to Major League men, prove to me that you can find better baseball players and hitters than the state of Alabama that produced, you know, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron and Tommy Aaron, Billy Williams,
uh-huh.
Tommy Agee, Cleon Jones, Amos Otis. Prove to me that there's a state in America that has better, that has greater baseball players than Alabama in the 50s that produced them brothers. Prove to me that.
There you go. Yeah. All these guys that love this sabermetric stuff, Tony. This flies right in their faces. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, if you go back and read the old black newspapers, then you would never know that kind of thing, because no, it was not reported by the Washington Post or the New York Times or whoever. It was always, you know, and think about it. These guys did this without the internet, without even, you know, you had to pay for every second of the phone calls you made. You know, and we had, you know, Trey Young out in Chicago would cover the user connections for the NBA SWAC, and, you know, the few Collie Nicholsons of the world who were out there, and, you know, they work, you know, and it shows, it debunks that crap about, you know, black people can't work together. You know, two things, explain black college sports, explain the Underground Railroad. We always been working together. You know, everybody is not even doing the same thing. So, I mean, something we don't need to be working together because we're not doing the same thing. So, you know.
Exactly.
Explain that fertile soil.
Not together,
you know what I'm saying? Explain that fertile soil, you know, in the South that was cultivated on that free labor for hundreds of years that feeds this nation.
You know, that's right.
And then tell me about teamwork. Don't start talking about calling someone dirty and filthy when for years, you know what I'm saying, these people cleaned your houses immaculately, breastfed your own children. You know what I'm saying? So how are you going to call someone dirty, filthy, this and that and the other, when they raised your whole entire family, cleaned your whole family, you know, cleaned your house, taught you the science of cleanliness, taught you the science of hygiene, taught you the science of neatness, because I got some intel and some documentation on the European culture. Bubonic plague, he never ran through the South or Africa.
Hello.
You know what I'm saying? Okay. I mean, you know, in terms of cleanliness, and in terms of, you know, hygiene, man. That's right. I mean, you know. Perfume was created to get rid of their stench.
Yeah.
It was these things were created to get rid of their natural stench of uncleanliness. I mean, you talk about how, you know, the Moorish empires of Spain, you know, Alhambra, you know what I'm saying, and all these places that had more libraries, indoor plumbing and bait. I mean, while the Pope had two books, while the Moorish, you know, libraries had, like, incredible historical references in terms of cultivation and hygiene, you know, where all the diseases start from, it's just through the ignorance and the sublimation of European conquest that the brothers in Africa suffered so badly with Ebola, and it's not because they lost their hygienic laws, because they were following the science of colonialism, which meant that it didn't render anything to hygiene.
when they ever talked about what Bill Gates talked about, just by having toilets in Africa could cause an 80% increase in life expectancy, a toilet. And we're the creators of that. That's what colonialism has done when you have mimicked this person behind money and wanting to be this individual, as you have put you in these bad positions when you're the masters of cleanliness and hygiene. I mean, these things just really bother me and hurt me when you start hearing this. I'm out of there. Let me get, I'm off the soapbox.
I want to stay with Eric went on that, because I want to go back to the plantation. Explain to me, since you started this shit, Eric, I love it. Explain to me how you're going to have separate drinking fountains for black folks and white folks, but your kids was raised on black tits. Now, I'm just,
for the other people, talking about breast milk, which we know is the most nutritive and value, and it's something we did while we were so strong. We didn't rely on cow's milk. And the fact that two things that come to mind to these points that people can use for points of reference as movies. We don't need them, but we need to give them for people to understand what we're talking about. One, to your point, what's that Oprah Winfrey movie when she was with Danny Glover? You know what I mean? That Danny Glover movie, which not Color Purple, the other one.
Kind of a bust-out one
where she killed her own children.
Beloved.
In that movie, Beloved, she is accosted by these, low-class, and they called them crackers themselves, right? Because that was the name of the field workers, white people, because they called them crackers and peckerwoods. You know what I'm saying? They called them that.
Yeah.
We use what they called them. So these peckerwoods and these crackers, these low-end white folks, or what they call white trash as well, pinned her down in that movie, and the first thing they did, they had contests so they could drink her breast milk for nutrition.
Yeah.
And Fred's point about the written history and our science, we blast Spike because we can do it because we're family. You know what I'm saying? We can blast them. I won't blast them. I won't blast them on network television. You know, amongst family, we can have these conversations. He did the thing in the Malcolm X movie where West Indian Archie was the numbers runner, the policy king that created all the things we call today the lottery all across this world, was created by our cultures and out of the inner city and black enclaves as a position of hope and a business pool in our economic communities. Delroy Lindo played this particular part where young Malcolm X went to him and he wanted to be a runner for him to do the policy or the numbers running or the lottery system in Harlem. And he says, hey, I need to write it down. First thing he told Malcolm, don't write it down. No paper trail. I keep everything in my head. And that was part of that oral tradition that was natural. And that's documented in that movie for those who need the point of reference of what we're talking about, just being able to do these things without that.
That's right. That's exactly right. They missed it all.
Dr. Kajuku talks about that. About the learning process with young black people. You say, we talk about, first and foremost, he reminds us that we invented most of the math, the higher math and sciences anyway. The proof of that is this whole simple thing called pyramids.
Right.
He takes it a step further. You take the same brother who's struggling with math and this kind of stuff, give him some marijuana or whatever your drug of choice may be. Put him on the street, and he can break this stuff down from inches and from ounces to metrics and all
there
that kind of stuff. He can.
Yeah.
It's just like a piece I wrote in the thing talking about Bloomberg Institute. They got upset. They were trying to trash them by their passing kids and giving them flunk courses. But you know how they talk physics to the basketball players? That's what they were already doing. Okay, from this point on the floor, how high do you have to put the ball up? At what speed does it have to travel? Something with basic physics. This is how they taught physics to basketball players. One of those kids came to our school at Pebble State. He was not a good basketball player other than just he was good. He could hit the boards and rebound, that kind of stuff. But he didn't really know the game that well. But, he would tell you quick, well, I'm going to keep with the education. Anyway, He graduated with honors from Pebble State, and he's got his MBA now. He's working in banking and finance, so I think he's real good at basketball because he used basketball to get where he needed to go. At the same time, you know, I look at the fact that this young man grasps all these concepts of physics and calculus or something, and this is why when he came to Pebble State, he took the same courses that he couldn't get coming out of high school. He took the same courses at the collegiate level. He made A's and B's in it.
That was cool.
So, you know, we do our kids at this level. You know, he's just a jock. Well, this same jock can come down the court on a breakaway, and he knows how to put the ball, put spot the heat on the backboard, on the run. He knows this because he's done this enough time, enough repetition. He has the right amount of force behind it, the right height, right speed, right rotation, all that other stuff. You know, this is why Dick Hodges say Cleo Hill was his most scientific player he'd ever met. Because Cleo could tell you in the dark if the ball was going in when it left his hand based on how he made it spin. And even his son never totally grasped it, but he understood what he was talking about because Cleo taught this to himself because he played by himself so much. But you know,
purely
intuitive.
It's called prior perception. It's a name for it. It's called prior perception. Yeah. It's purely intuitive.
You know,
it's kind of like this. It's kind of like. Has anyone ever done this? I gave an example when I'm talking about. Has anyone ever done this where you have a beverage, right, that you be it a coffee cup or a soft drink cup, right? You know, one with the straw and the plastic top on it, right? And it, say you were drinking some of it, you know, it didn't start full when you had it, right? You sipped on it. But now you want to transfer it, right, to another cup or glass, right? So you go to the cabinet, you got all kinds of cups, right? You know, you got coffee cups, a short 8-inch, 10-inch, 12, right? You got different sizes, different shapes. Uh-huh. And you grab one out, right, out of the cabinet, you know, on it, right? And you pour out the beverage you had that was, you know, in the cup with the straw and transfer it to the one you just took out the cabinet. How often do you do that and it's a perfect fit when you pour it?
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
How often do you choose that instinctively, intuitively, without even doing the measurement, you know what I'm saying? But you make it the right, and you pour it to the top, and it never spills. It fits perfectly. And you have about 20 choices in your cupboard to pick from.
Uh-huh.
I say that to say, because I give that to people. That's called prior perception, where it says if you could crystallize what you were able to do, you basically would have like created like a geometrical map that manifested etherically that you couldn't see physically, that you just intuitively made out of connectivity out of the power of your touch. That's what happens in sports, per se. No one ever talks like I just said. You know what I'm saying? But tonight's the night,
right?
You know what I'm saying? Tonight's the night. And so what happens is that is an actual function. It's an actual thing. So what happens with these brothers like Fred talked about that are able to do that, they understand that's talent. They understand that's a wisdom. They understand that's a once-in-a-lifetime fact. That's why they pay it millions of dollars. But as long as the other parts of that prior perception is not measured and the other mental development, that's where the shortcomings come in, and that's where the disservice comes in with what these universities do.
That's amazing. You know, if you're a basketball coach now, based on everything you and Fred just said, if I'm on the sideline talking to a bunch of young men, I would tell them, you are all mathematicians. I wouldn't call them players. I would call them mathematicians. And the same way that you and Fred broke that down, I'm sure that they not only would swallow that, it would go into them via osmosis, and they would execute in a major way. Because
that sounds like
execution, all right, but I digress. Since you mentioned that, I got to go to Fred, because Fred dropped this little ditty on me before we went on air tonight. Fred, tell them about your view of what you saw or what you think we see between Wisconsin and the opposition that they're going to go against, please.
Oh, they got new Nike. Nike just released a new Jordan shoe, and they were supposedly getting some. There was some question about whether or not they could get it cleared in time, but, you know, this is the brand they wear. And my thing was to watch and see what the call, because I don't know if Carolina won or not, because, I mean,
they got beat. They lost. Roy wins, does it again.
Carolina lost.
Roy wins screwed up again, that's all I'm going to say.
Well, I must contact my nephew. He's on the show.
Be like that.
Only thing they have working for him is their nickname, you know, which is that black tribe down there, those wolves, you know, and not the Lumbees, the Tar Heels. That's another story.
There you go.
Screwed up.
Having said that, I'm not surprised at all. I mean,
Yeah.
It's okay to have a good come to Jesus moment and all that kind of stuff. But see,
and I
understand part of the concept that they're trying to apply. That's the same one that the South Africans applied after apartheid was ended, formal apartheid was ended. If you're so sorry and that kind of stuff, if you're so sorry, why did we have to come get you to apologize? Why
thank you.
Have to come to me for you to apologize. Why didn't you come to me? You know, my mom made me go apologize to my cousin and give my belt back to him. I did not invoke that on him. I just told him he had an hour to get it back to me, or I'd see him, you know. I'm apologizing because Mama said I had to, so you can tell her that I did. Apologize. I'm sorry. Here's the belt, and if you want to keep it, you can. But as far as I'm concerned, you got 1 hour to get my belt back to me, or I'm okay. I won't see you. And I said not see you with it all. And so after about an hour, it was less than an hour, he came back to deliver, and I gladly took it back. He shook hands right there for my mom. And, because she couldn't get to walk out of the house at the time, I walked out to the little bridge between our house, we had a little creek in front of our house, I walked out to the bridge with him and let him know that he had never spilled nothing else from me. But, sarcasm aside, I think that the NAACP just showed its true colors again, just like the little cracker boys showed their true colors again. And they only sorry because they got caught. And, just accept that for what it is, I wouldn't waste a whole lot of brain power on it because it ain't going to get no better. Until we start thinking more of ourselves, and depending on them kind of people, and then and only then will we get out of this what we go after. And my thing is, it ain't gonna get no better.
There you go. Reggie, cynicism or betrayal? What did you feel, or something else?
So it's always betrayal. I mean, you have a fool down there in L.A. who will pay one of the biggest fines for slumlord, and then it'll be an outstanding citizen. Not one of the And now in state, they revealed that it's a fraternity there. They had a racist book that was talked about today. And I will get a present there. I mean, I have to yield to the great Senator Dr. Witt from North Carolina on this one because I don't know if NC State, since the days of what's the young man, Bob Thompson.
David Thompson was my first roommate, homeboy classmate. One of the nicest guys you would ever meet on this earth. Country is corn shuck or worse. But at the same time, though, David Thompson actually graduated from Shaw University. He did not graduate from North Carolina State.
They always retreat back to the HBCU. That's true. Imagine if he would have played some ball at Shaw, as opposed to NC State. That's another story.
That's definitely another story. That's intriguing.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, we talked about that. You know, we talked about, you know, like when we talked about Crowell, well, this, that, and the other. I mean, the chime in to the point, like, I have not followed one iota of this story. You know, I mean, because we can just do, you know, and go coast to coast with this, you know, in terms of university. But, you know, we've talked about this. We talked about
trying
to go to these Ivy League schools, getting the Mickey pulled on them. We talked, you know, Adrian Peterson went to, you know, Oklahoma University. We talked about how, you know, the guys that get no run for the Nebraska and the Big 12, as well as Oklahoma, what would happen if they went to HBCU and played ball? And now they look like fools, you know, trying to justify what took place and trying to find some apologies, and they lost one scholarship athlete. We talked about, you know, a blue-chip recruit out of Tennessee, whose mother's an athletic director at a prominent HBCU, and she's celebrating and doing, you know, doing the splits, but doing the robot Michael Jackson moonwalk, you know what I mean, for her son to go to another school one moment he announces, you follow? So what we see is we see these idiots all the time. And so to me, you know, I didn't really need that to verify that's what takes place at those universities, because some of the biggest racist camps, organized camps, you know what I mean, separatists, are in those states, you know what I mean, where, you know, they got every level of weapon and rifle, and, you know, they want to break away. They got every form of militia. You can imagine in those states, highly organized, highly financed, you know what I mean, but they all pause just to win a football game. Marcus Dupree, one of the greatest, you know, running backs that ever got lost with Oklahoma. Switzer was talking about when he was coaching. I mean, Switzer, you know, as gangster as Switzer's program was, and all the criminal events that took place when Switzer was coaching at Oklahoma. My goodness, I mean, you know, I mean, Switzer's on record as, you know, he's a bootlegger's boy. He talks about how his father's a bootlegger in the black community, and, you know, all his girlfriends were black, you know, this, that, and the other, and daddy, and this, that, and the other. You know, and so you have to walk around. Yeah, you know, I mean, he talks about how black athletes never need to use steroids. He says, all my years of being around athletes, steroids were not made for black athletes. They were made for white athletes. He says that. Switzer is the Super Bowl winning coach of the Cowboys.